It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Think about the last fiction book you might have read. If you're like me, you probably remember the author's name, what the cover looked like, and, you know, some of the content of the book itself. How about the publisher? Do you know who that was? Maybe, maybe not. Chances are, if it was a work of fiction published in the last decade or so, the publisher was Penguin, Random House, Hachette, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, or Macmillan. These publishing companies are known as the Big Five. They control over 80% of the trade book market in the United States. Last year, Penguin Random House tried to purchase Simon & Schuster for over $2 billion. That merger was blocked by the government over concerns about competition. That attempted merger is part of a decades-long trend of consolidation in the publishing industry. And our next guest says it's about more than money and business decisions. In his new book, he looks at the rise of publishing giants and how that shaped what ends up on bookshelves and the reading experience itself. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you read a lot of fiction, a particular genre? If so, do you follow any particular authors, self-published or on the bookshelves or online? How do you discover new fiction? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Sinikin is an assistant professor of English at Emory University. His latest book is Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
You trace kind of a before and after in your book with where a lot has changed in the publishing industry. Give us a taste of what the publishing industry looked like 50, 60 years ago at the outset of your book.
Sure. So in the 1950s, the publishing industry looked completely different than it does today. Back then, you had a bunch of small independent publishing houses that were run and owned by the founders or the heirs of the founders in many or most cases. That started to change in the 1960s when businesses started to consolidate the industry. And as you said in the intro, this gradually increased through the 70s, 80s, and 90s to the point where now five companies control something like 80% of the business.
And as I mentioned, your book traces, you know, what does that mean for the books that get published and what we read? But one really big point I think you try to make is there wasn't necessarily a golden age. You don't make the case that the 50s were necessarily the good old days.
That's right. There was a lot of racism in publishing. There was a lot of misogyny in publishing that I trace in those earlier days. There still is some of that today, but we've seen that decrease. So you wouldn't want to paint a picture. And I also think that we're still in a world where lots of great books get published. It's just the kinds of constraints that writers published within today have changed, and the kind of rules of the game that determine the kind of stories that they write have changed.
And a key factor in your book is, you know, as a reader, I think of a fiction book as, you know, a thing by that author. They do this creative work. If it's good enough, gosh, they get a publishing contract. Eventually, if it's so good, I find out about it and read it and enjoy it. You really focus in on the book industry as creating commercial products, right? Things that are marketed and sold to people like you and me. Tell us a little bit about how the book world looks different through that lens.
Sure. So one of the opening moves I make in the book is to ask readers to think about the publishing company and the little symbol on the spine of the book. If you look at the spine of your book down near the bottom, you'll see a little symbol. And that symbol is sometimes called a colophon. And that is the symbol for that publishing company. And there's a whole world of people who live within that colophon, who are in that publishing industry, who helped make the book that you have. And that whole system contributes to what's in the pages of most any book. This can be kind of extreme in some cases, like the Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew, where there was a whole fiction factory called the Stratemeyer Syndicate of lots of different writers who would write those books, even though they were all published under one pseudonym to make them seem as if they were by one author. And there's lots of cases of ghostwriters or developmental editors helping out, editors doing a lot of hands-on work, literary agents really help shaping books. Cases where people from marketing and sales have a lot of control over the kinds of books that get acquired and thus the kind of taste that a publishing house is going to end up having in the way the books look on that list. So there's a whole world of people who end up shaping books, even I would say by some of the people we most imagine to be those autonomous authors, those romantic authors, kind of singular geniuses of American literature like Cormac McCarthy or Toni Morrison. Even them, I think, are subject to the forces of the publishing industry.
Talking to Dan Senekin about his new book, Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an author, love to hear your experience in getting published or trying to get published. If you've worked in the book industry, love to hear your take on how things might have changed over the years. Join in at 800-642-1234. Give us a taste, Dan, of how this conglomeration, all these industry mergers might have changed what we see on the bookshelf or the virtual bookshelf, as the case may be.
For sure. So in 2023, some of the biggest trends in books are romance. You might think of someone like Colleen Hoover, who sells just an outrageous number of books, or fantasy. Brandon Sanderson is a name, someone who sells just, again, an outrageous number of books. And in the book, I argue that the rise of fantasy and romance as popular genres in 2023 has everything to do with the conglomeration of publishing. And that really begins when conglomeration gains control over the industry in the mid to late 70s. What happened was publishing companies started to get demands from their owners for quarterly growth. They suddenly had a lot more pressures to make a profit than they did previously in a regular quarter-by-quarter profit. At the same time, the 70s was a tough time to sell books because there was bad inflation, wages were stagnating, consumers had less money to buy them. So publishers really had to figure out a way out of this pickle. One of the things they did is they followed the path that was led by a little Canadian company called Harlequin. Harlequin, of course, became known for its romance novels. And in particular, they didn't necessarily have famous novelists. They got famous as a publishing company and for writing series of books that they would pay hack writers. They wouldn't pay their authors a ton of money, so they'd be cheap to make. And then people would recognize, oh, Harlequin, I know the kind of romance books that they publish. I'm going to buy those and then get hooked on those and keep reading these series of books one after another. So other publishing companies realized that they could make money on that model, particularly in the genres of romance, which boomed in the 1980s, and fantasy, which wasn't really a mass popular genre. It wasn't a genre at all in the way we understand it until the wake of the Lord of the Rings books, which became famous only in the late 1960s and weren't made into a genre until the late 1970s, really to kind of help publishing companies make these profits under their new owners. So the 1980s, when you started having these chain bookstores in shopping malls that were going up all over the suburbs, were ideal to sell romance and fantasy, because here you had moms shopping the shopping malls, maybe taking their kids, their tweens or young teens, and the moms would buy the romance books and the tweens would buy the fantasy books. And that world that was created by conglomeration in the 1980s is still the world of books we're living with today.
Can you talk about the change in the dominant figures in the industry? Early on, it seems like the editors had so much latitude over who they'd work with and what kind of things they'd publish and what changes then they demand. At different stages in the story you tell, it might be, you know, the buyer for Borders or Barnes & Noble, and now the gatekeepers. I'm not sure who the gatekeepers are. How has that changed over this time period?
Yeah, so people talk about the great Maxwell Perkins as this editor who had this immense power shaping the work of Thomas Wolfe and discovered Ernest Hemingway and worked with F. Scott Fitzgerald. And the story of early 20th century publishing is often told as the story of the editor and the writer working together. With the rise of conglomeration, you just start to have a lot more hands on deck and a lot more forces shaping the kinds of books that we read, much beyond just the editor and the writer. And this is in part because as the demands to sell more books and sell them more efficiently increases, the job of the editor becomes less about acquiring and editing books, especially less about editing books, and more the role of a manager overseeing the movement of that book from one part of the publishing company to another and making sure it gets published well and is successful as a commodity. So the editor has less and less time to edit, and that gets replaced by figures such as the literary agent, especially. The literary agent becomes necessary in a way that he or she wasn't before, starting in the 1970s. And the agent becomes this figure who becomes a powerful advocate for the writer, which also wasn't exactly true prior to the 1970s. They had been more a neutral mediator, but they really became an advocate for the author in the 1970s. And the agent, the literary agent, has different motives than the editor. The literary agent is paid on a commission and a percentage of how much the book sells. And so the agent is really looking out for markets, is kind of the embodiment of the invisible hand of the market, and helping guide American fiction toward a more market-oriented approach overall.
Talking to Dan Senekin, assistant professor of English at Emory University, talking about his new book. It's called Big Fiction: How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. Looking at the ways that money and power in publishing have shaped the state of the fiction that comes to you at a bookstore, if you go to bookstores, on Amazon, or wherever you go to find fiction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a reader, how do you look for that next book, that next author? Are you looking for stuff that's kind of like things you've read already, or do you have ways to branch out? It can be hard to do these days, even though there's so much fiction out there. If you are a writer and have tried to publish a book by yourself or sell it to someone, love to hear your experience. Or if you're in the industry on one of those many job titles that Dan just hinted at, love to hear your perspective as well. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with professor and author Dan Senekin about his new book, Big Fiction: How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow certain publishers or labels because you know they print the books that you like to read? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Altoona. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just read To Set a Watchman, a couple of months ago, and I was surprised how different it was from To Kill a Mockingbird. So when Harper Lee had written this, as probably a lot of people know, it was heavily, heavily edited by her publisher, and it really changed it into a completely different book. They couldn't be more different, especially some of the most tender parts of To Kill a Mockingbird that make it such a classic for kids and for people interested in basically like racial rights and things like that, were really not there in her original writing. And so I just wanted to point out that some of the work that publishers do with their authors, even though it might seem like it's pointed towards commercial success of the books, has really produced some really wonderful literature too. And To Set a Watchman, that was just one of the an example that came up to me.
John, thanks for the call. Dan, what do you think?
Go Set a Watchman. I mean, it's a complicated example because some people argue that Harper Lee was very old at the time and was entering senility. And some feel as though that book was merely an earlier draft of To Kill a Mockingbird, and that in it you see Atticus Finch as less sympathetic. He is revealed as actually a bit of a racist in Go Set a Watchman, rather than the kind of champion of anti-racism that he seems to be in To Kill a Mockingbird. But it was a book that had an immense, I mean, everyone wanted to buy and read that book. I bought it the day it came out. I was myself disappointed with it, but it sold an incredible amount of copies. And so the publisher had great financial incentives to sell that book. And, you know, some people like the reader might think that the editing on the book was strong and made it a good book. My own opinion is that it probably would have been better to keep that one in the archives.
John, thanks for going. I think John was saying, if I'm not mistaken, the editing on the original To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh,
was good.
Yeah. No, the editing on the To Kill a Mockingbird, you can see the way that the movement from the earlier draft and go. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Thank you. The earlier draft of Ghost Out of Watchmen is just much less of a book than To Kill a Mockingbird. So you see that the way the editor helped develop that book into Kill a Mockingbird was instrumental in making the classic. Yes, thank you.
And then John's point about that collaborative model. I mean, you mentioned earlier Cormac McCarthy. You read also in the book about David Foster Wallace. I think two authors who people think of as having a really unique voice, accurately, I think that's fair to say, but that there was a fairly long and involved and in some cases contentious collaborative process with their publishers to make them have a chance at commercial success too.
Yeah, but both are absolutely fascinating instances, the careers of both David Foster Wallace and Cormac McCarthy. And you really see, after you explore, like I did, their archives and their relationships with their publishers and their agents and their editors, the way in which the relationship with their publishers deeply shaped the kind of work they did. In the case of Cormac McCarthy, you have him writing the first half of his career from the early 1960s through the 1980s, really under the guidance and the care of an editor named Albert Erskine, who was an editor of the old school. He was actually the last editor for William Faulkner, a writer to whom McCarthy often is compared. And he protected McCarthy from conglomeration and the demands of the marketplace, allowing McCarthy to write these very strange, eccentric, difficult books that didn't sell very many copies. In fact, at one point, all five of his first novels went out of print, and he would write in letters to people in the late 80s that he had never made a single cent in royalty checks from any of his books, even though he'd been a professional writer for near 30 years. But Erskine retired in the mid to late 80s and died, and McCarthy realized he didn't know whether or not he had a future in publishing without Erskine there to help him. And so what he did is he sought out an agent, and he got a very high-powered agent. He got one of the most high-powered agents in the game, and she set him up with a new editor and a new team of folks, moving him from Random House to Knopf, which was an imprint within Random House. And this whole team really shaped a new kind of Cormac McCarthy. And he came out with a book in 1992, All the Pretty Horses, which was a different style. It was much closer to a classic Western. I kind of think of it like Louis L'Amour, but done in Cormac McCarthy's voice. It's a Western Western. And it sold 100,000 copies out the gate. And they made a movie with Matt Damon. It won the National Book Award, but it was a much more digestible, marketable book than his previous work. And so that's a case where you can really see the force of conglomeration on a single writer's career.
Let's go back to our callers. Cheryl is with us in Eau Claire. Cheryl, hi.
Hi there. Yes, I have several series authors that I'll always be on the lookout for a book, and I can't wait for them. I moved and I have older books now, and I'll take them to Savers or Goodwill, but with the price of hardcover books, that plays a factor in my price, purchasing of books. But certain authors, like certain actors, I'll always buy their books.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for the call. Dan, and it seems like more and more the conglomerates are looking for that franchise author, whether they're actually writing a franchise, but somebody who people like Cheryl, and Cheryl's certainly not alone, once they find that author, they go back to again and again. I look for that kind of author, too.
Oh, yeah, sure, I do, too. And that is a great way for publishers to figure out how to make their sales more predictable. Is if they can make the author into a well-known brand, then they're in good shape. And one of the classic ways that they did this, starting in the late 1970s, they built out their marketing departments, which were much smaller in the 1950s and 1960s, and they invested in making authors household names. And they did this with people in the late 1970s like Stephen King or Daniel Steele, or then Tom Clancy and John Grisham, names that are still, especially Grisham, King, and Steele, they're still writing, and they're still at the top of our bestseller lists today. And this is something that's really often done in partnership with the publishing house, who are helping create these names so that they can have dependable sales.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Dan Senekin about his latest book, Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. Dan, I have an acquaintance who is an author here in Wisconsin. He had a genre book that had some success. He went to his publisher and said, hey, I've got this idea for another character and another genre. And like, yeah, that's great. Or you could do a sequel with exactly the same character and their further adventures kind of thing. And that's what he ended up doing. How much pressure is there to have sequels and maybe things that can be turned into movies and blockbusters and things like that these days?
Yeah, that's a great anecdote. And it shows how sometimes the way the books that we read, there's gentle nudges from publishing houses. The incentives for them to sell books can just kind of help push a writer in one direction or another. And there's many books we could have seen in the world, like your friend's book that he didn't write, that never appear because of the way the publishing world is structured. And so, yes, there's a lot of incentives to do sequels and to do stuff that is built as a series from the outset, because if readers liked the first one, they'll keep buying the next ones.
In our last minute or so, Dan, you've covered, 60, 70 years of history. What trend, what development are you watching for right now?
So it's what's been really wild in the last decade are a few things. One is the immense amount of writing and reading that is done on the internet in self-publishing, fan fiction, and sites like Wattpad, where especially younger women and girls are doing an immense amount of writing fiction and reading fiction collectively in the genres of romance and fantasy especially. I'm also looking at the growth of audio. Audiobooks have become enormously popular in the last decade and are expected to continue to grow. And finally, artificial intelligence is already changing the way people, especially in self-publishing, are writing. And I think that's something we're all going to want to keep an eye on in the years to come.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dan Senekin, assistant professor of English at Emory University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature, and how trends in the publishing industry shape the world of books for better sometimes and sometimes worse. You can share your favorite book franchises if you have one, if you actually follow particular publishers, or if you have a story of how you found out about a particular author that you've come to know and love. Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.